and welcome to Big Web Show, episode number 128, Everything Web That Matters. My guest today is former recovering New York Times design director Coy Vinh.
Hello. Author,
hey, Coy. Coy is the author of How They Got There, interviews with digital designers about their careers coming this year. He's also the author of Ordering Disorder, Grid Principles for Web Design, a new writer's book from 2010. In 2011, he was named one of the 50 most influential designers in America by Fast Company. He is the creator of Wildcard, a new, faster way to get what you need from the mobile web.
I'm actually just a team member there.
A team member?
Yes.
The hubris was mine, not Coy's. I, just knowing him as I do, I read it so much into it. Coy, today's episode is sponsored by DreamHost. We thank them and we will have more to say about them shortly. But Coy, let's get right into it. Tell me about your book, How They Got There, interviews with digital designers about their careers. It's coming what month?
I'm hoping it's going to come out in the next couple of weeks. It's an electronic book, so I don't need to worry about physical distribution or anything. And I'm putting the finishing touches on it right now.
What stage of production is it in?
Everything is edited, and we're just tying up some loose ends with the EPUB and Mobi versions, which are a headache, and some of the marketing stuff. But it's like 99% there.
You designed it as if it were a print book and did a PDF version first, and now you're doing the EPUB, or how did that work?
Yes, I designed it in InDesign to look like a printed book that will read nicely on a digital device. And then I use InDesign's helpful but not perfect output mechanisms for EPUB, and then translated it to Mobi, which is this whole other world I did not know about, and I'm working my way through it.
One wishes one didn't have to.
Yeah.
Who is your editor?
I worked with Sue Applebaum, who you've worked with, right? She's fantastic.
I know her. Yeah, she's fantastic.
She's a fantastic, cool. Really, like, just tracks down every last detail. It's just really great.
And who's producing the ebook for you?
The ebook I just did myself. I just did right out of InDesign. So it was easy enough to do. It's not the most complicated book. There are actually no illustrations inside. It's really just a series of interviews.
So no photos?
Very straightforward. No photos.
Yeah. And no samples of their work.
No. And that's part of the premise of the book. I feel like the people that I interviewed have fantastic portfolios and done some amazing work. But what really interested me was hearing about how they got their first big breaks, how they went into this line of work, how they cobbled together, you know, jobs and opportunities and turned them into careers.
What was really, the thinking behind starting this book? How did you get you were taking a shower and what happened?
I was taking a shower and I realized this is the part of everybody's story that always interests me the most, because I don't know about you, Jeffrey, but for me, regardless of what stage I've found myself in my career, I've always thought about, okay, how do I make that next leap, or how do I transition out of what I'm doing now into something I want to do, you know, more of next year. Yeah. And so it's always, careers are always about constantly looking for opportunities to reinvent yourself. And when I've read, you know, about this aspect of the careers of my design heroes, I've always found those to be the most interesting. And I never really could get enough of that. And I also realized
most people
that,
don't talk about that.
Right. They don't. I mean, because there's always some dark years, right? And there's always some you know, lost weekends or you know, bouts of you know, indirection, lack of direction.
It would be great to hear about that, so that people don't feel so alone. Because one of the things people in any kind of alternative self-directed business do is quit, right? Whether it's acting or music or poetry or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If you're not successful for, you know, your first month, well, that's okay. But if if it's 2 years and yeah. you know, your spouse is giving you dirty looks and you got kids on the way, whatever, yeah. you know, it's very easy to quit. So I having the dark years of some of our legendary designers, it would be a good thing, I would think.
Yeah, I think it's really illuminating. I think what you just said about it being easy to quit is especially true when the profiles that you read about successful designers always seem to gloss over any, you know, trials and tribulations they might have had in early on in their careers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so what it I discovered when like I started somebody's doing these interviews... Doing,
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So what I discovered when I started doing these interviews is there's lots of wasted time or lots of, you know, going down the wrong path and having to double back and you know, take stock again. I think it's true for everybody. And that was very illuminating for me, even though I sort of intellectually knew it. Like once I talked to these people, I understood it on a much more, you know, emotional level.
Who surprised you?
Who surprised me? See, there's a great interview with Karen McGrane of Bond Art and Science. She's been in the industry for a long time.
Yeah, 20 years.
Yeah, right. And she's got a fantastic reputation. And it really surprised me how she looks at herself as, you know, sort of being in the business of surviving each wave of technological change. I always sort of assumed like she had such a great reputation that it was easy for her to do that. But she's always looking at like how to adapt to the current wave and thinking about how long it's going to last and trying to figure out how she's going to get to the next one.
Boy, do I relate to that? That's but I don't think about it enough. That right. proves that she is much smarter than me.
I mean, right?
Yeah, you can be like so. Imagine. Remember Yakov Smirnov? He was the comedian who talked about, you know, in Soviet yeah. Union, party watches you. He didn't actually yeah. do that many turnarounds, but that's what he's known for. But right. and then the Cold War ended and he was sort of left jobless. You did a book in 2010 about grids.
Yeah.
Which are still part of responsive design, of course, but you know, you were bringing, you know, fixed width and the order of graphic design to the web. You were one of the people leading that charge, and then suddenly everything's liquid and spongy again. And you can, you know, unless you adapt to that change.
Yeah, that's absolutely like, right. I mean, that book, I like to think there are some foundational principles in there, but that book is not going to help you a lot today if you really want to master the way, you know, leading edge web design is really done with regards to grids. I think it's a whole different ballgame now.
If you were using that book today as your reputation maker seeking clients, you would have trouble. Just as if I'm seeking clients by saying, you know, semantic markup and web standards are really important, I'm in trouble. Because clients want to hear about the multi-platform world, and they want to hear about mobile, they want to hear about responsive. You know, my story's old. So yeah, Karen's very smart, mm-hmm. and I think we all can find ourselves at times going like, "Wow, my skills! Mm-hmm. I was so happy with my skills. I was so happy with my point of view on what this stuff is, and somehow it's changed under my feet."
Yeah, I think that's a lesson also for young designers too, who are absolute masters of their craft today, and don't realize that, you know, this industry really turns over every 4 or 5 years.
Right. Okay, you're young still, but I'm well into middle age. So like, I can jealously I saw some guy, some like 20 something guy with like long, beautiful hair at some concert, and I actually found myself like a super cranky old man going, enjoy it, you'll have bald spots soon. I didn't say that, I just thought it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so yeah. Like, enjoy those washboard apps. See if you have them at 40.
I feel like you and I are a lot closer together than I am to that 20-year-old guy right now. I think mathematically that's the way it would shake out.
I can't think about the math. I'm bad at math, especially like how old I am and how long I've been doing stuff. I'm really bad at that math. But what other lessons have come out of the book from other folks you interviewed?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things is, you know, that old saw about it's who you know, it's not what you know, which people repeat kind of cynically. But I think what I found to be true in all of these interviews is you know, the people that you work with matter just about as much as the work that you do. Like forming really good bonds and working hard to establish a quote unquote network of folks who can open a door that leads to another door is so critical in some cases. And sometimes that can be, you know, college folks or, you know, coworkers, or sometimes it can be family, like Nicholas Felton of, you know, the famous Feltron annual
right.
report. One of his first big breaks came through a friend of his mom's, who ran a design studio, and that's how he got a proper design job. I thought that was really, really fascinating, because he seems like a guy who's had so much raw talent that his path always seemed inevitable. But you know, even he, you know, was able to benefit from, you know, these really lucky breaks that happen every once in a while.
Sure, Prince had a musician father. It doesn't hurt. Prince, like, you can't take away that guy's genius and talent. It's ridiculous. As, you know, just if he didn't write those songs but just played guitar, he'd still be amazing. If he couldn't play guitar but just sang like that, he'd still be amazing. Like, multi-talented on every way. But he still had a family in the business.
Yeah.
Right?
I
was talking to my friend Samantha Warren, best known for Style Tiles, but she was a designer at Twitter. And she was talking about growing up in her, you know, her family's print shop. That when she was 14, while other kids were maybe working at McDonald's or something, she was helping her family print. And her dad was real into linotype and real into then new digital typesetting methods. And that had to have an influence on who she is and on her abilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually remember when I first moved to New York in my 20s, I have an aunt who lives in Westchester, and she and her husband worked on Wall Street for decades and were not anywhere associated with the design business. But they had a friend who worked in an ad agency, and they took me to see him, and that didn't lead anywhere. But I'm just so thankful for their generosity at that point. And who knows, like maybe that could have led somewhere if I had followed up on it or something. So you never really know where these opportunities are going to come from. And you know, just because it's a given opportunity isn't like a really clear pointer towards your intended goal, it doesn't mean it's not going to be like super valuable for you.
Super formative. Right. Right. Yeah. I wanted to be an animator when I was 11, 12. Mm-hmm. And we were in Disneyland. My family took us to Disneyland, and my mom somehow arranged a behind the scenes tour where we met animators.
Wow.
I don't know. You can't do that anymore, because I tried to do the same thing for my daughter when we were in Disneyland last year. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist anymore. I don't even know if she called in favors. Not that she was like Hollywood mom or something. No, I mean, we lived in Connecticut, so she didn't know anybody. But it was really formative. I didn't become an animator, but I'm a designer. It's like, it was really formative to go see that it was possible to have a job where you got to do stuff you usually get yelled at for in school. Like, if you're drawing instead of taking notes in school, people mm-hmm. yelled at you. But here were these people drawing all day long, and they were part of this respected organization making this magical stuff.
That must have been really amazing. What an experience.
The other experience that was really formative is when my mom took me into the ladies' room at but that was a completely different experience, so I won't do that. But, so how did you conduct these interviews?
Sure. Much like you and I are talking right now, I called folks on Skype, and I recorded the interviews right onto my laptop, and then I uploaded it to a service called rev.com, which transcribes the contents and sends you back a Word file in less than 24 hours. It's actually really handy and really affordable. And I thought...
Rev.com is a transcription service?
Yes, rev.com.
And how much does that cost?
I think it was about $1 a minute. So for an hour long interview, roughly, you know, it's about $60. So very, very affordable. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That gives me an idea for this show. But
Really?
Yeah. I think that's wow.
Well, one of the things I discovered was you can get a transcription done quickly, but that then to turn it into something that's readable is a whole other level of work, and that's where Sue really stepped up. Yeah. So we spent a lot of last year hammering each of these 14 interviews into shape, like turning the verbatim transcription into something that flowed naturally and was true to what the interview subject was actually trying to say, and not exactly the words that they used. That was eye-opening for me.
Showing it to them for approval?
I did not do that for approval, but I did give everybody a chance to look at it after I had considered everything locked down. And
hi, I'm not changing anything. Have a look.
Yeah, right. Okay. I didn't want people to feel like they could go back and change answers, but if they felt like there were factual errors or there were things that we just got wrong in the transcription, I was happy to make those changes.
Sure. Yeah. Let's go. How did you pick the 14 designers? Who are they?
So we have Mr. Dan Cederholm of Dribbble, who's no stranger to this show.
Right.
We have Alex Cornell, who is at FireSpotter Labs, Nick Felton from Felton Annual Reports and Datum.
They were both at New York Times at one point, though, yes?
No, those folks weren't. I mean, Nicholas did a bunch of freelance illustration work, but...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. And why is Andrew's name so familiar to me?
Alex Cornell?
Alex Cornell.
Yeah. So Alex is, he's really talented kid. I met him when he was doing his graduate degree. And he, in addition to being a top-notch product designer, interface designer, he has also done a whole bunch of really interesting video work, like self-initiated video projects. And he's started a company now... I can't remember the name of his new company, but he focuses exclusively on doing product videos in the sort of Adam Lissagor, Lonely Sandwich vein for tech companies. He started that last year, and he's doing a really bang-up job with it. And like his post-production work on the videos is really beautiful. He's done some fantastic work. So I tried to pick people, in addition to Dan and Nick Felton, I tried to pick people like Alex, who were less well-known but had put together a really interesting career, had really interesting career paths, nevertheless. I also try to pick people who were, further along in their career or were just starting out, try to get a good mix of men as well as women. There was no real scientific method to this group of 14. I just sort of started with a few names and then I just tried to see where that led me. And then you would periodically circle back and look at the whole group and see who else I could add to it that would make it, a more interesting, grab bag.
Cool. And how did you arrange the interviews? Is there some kind of arc to the storytelling of it, or is it by years of experience or height?
I thought I was going to do that, but then I sat down and I just listed everybody in alphabetical order, and that actually seemed to work really nicely. And I said that's very nicely sidesteps any sort of errors of judgment that I might make. So I just used that approach.
Cool.
Yeah. The alphabet saved again by the alphabet.
And what's the most exciting thing to you about the book?
I think for me, the most exciting thing is to have this book out there that I really wanted to read it myself. I actually wanted this book when I was in my 20s, starting out my career. And that's the itch that I wanted to scratch. I wanted to show that everybody's careers, are improvised to some degree and
sure.
and are unique and are interesting, and there are lessons to learn from those stories. For me, it's sort of like a playbook that that you can use when you're thinking about, you know, about your own career, regardless of what stage you're at, whether you're starting out or even when you're further along. I mean, there were a lot of times when I was conducting these interviews that I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I'm going to remember that for myself. So I learned quite a bit from it. So it's exciting to just to have this thing that I wanted for myself out there.
I think that too. And I teach, in fact, you're my guest lecturer tonight. And I teach a class at School of Visual Arts that does pretty much the same thing. It's about careers and types of work environments and you know, what type of person are you and where will you be happiest doing what kind of work with what kind of people?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Actually, I mean, I imagine you've learned some interesting lessons from teaching that class about how designers today think about their career starting out. That would be really interesting.
I've learned how accidental. I thought it was just me that had an accidental career, but a lot of people.
Yeah,
that I met, it, like they blundered into this or that. They, especially with the web, that kind of makes sense because it's not like there was a 500-year heritage of web design and people said when they were 3 years old, I want to be a web designer. Now right. There are people who can say when they're 5 years old, they want to be a web designer. But when you and I got started, that it was a brand new field. So,
right.
You know, we were doing something else. Either you were in school and then started doing web design or yeah. You were doing something else professionally or unprofessionally and said, wow, this looks better.
Yeah,
how did you become you?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I mean, I guess I had I was fortunate enough to know that I always wanted to do something in the arts. I mean, like you, I think I spent a lot of time drawing when I was in, you know, in high school and hoped to be able to do that as I grew older. And so I went to art school to study painting and illustration. But along the way, I discovered that the problems I was interested in were really all design related, like sort of figuring out how to present information and order things and make them elegant and usable. So that led me initially to pursue a career in graphic design and branding
What was the first thing you looked at as a kid and said, like not a drawing, but something else, something graphic design where you said, oh, I want to do that?
Yeah, I remember distinctly, I don't remember the very first thing, but I remember distinctly I got my hands on Neville Brody's first book, the famous British designer. He designed The Face magazine and built an amazing career.
Nike campaign.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember reading through that book, like every word on every page of that book, like over the course of several weeks and just absorbing it and realizing, wow, this is a really exciting world that makes a lot of sense to me. And sort of the combination of like a very graphic design, creating a very visceral sort of aesthetic impact as well as being underpinned by very intellectual pursuits, particularly around typography and semantics, that was really intoxicating to me. And I remember just sort of luxuriating in that book for several weeks when I was in art college. And it was a big deal for me.
Did you ever, like, I can remember my parents moved to Pittsburgh and we were driving around downtown Pittsburgh and I was just agog looking at the neon. This old funky neon signage. And like I remember one in particular, there were two dogs fighting over a stocking.
Yeah.
It just seemed completely bizarre when you're a kid. Now I realize it was supposed to demonstrate our hosiery is so sturdy that even if dogs were fighting over it, it wouldn't break. But at the time, it just seemed like something out of a dream.
Right.
Woman's stocking and two dogs biting it. It was just crazy.
But even that fascination that you had with that imagery in the neon sort of shows, you know, that you were interested back then, even in this kind of visual communication, right?
Yeah, I wish I was better at it too. Do you have that feeling like, God, I suck pretty much all the time?
Yes. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of imposter syndrome going on for me, and I heard that frequently in these interviews as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually in reading them, I thought, oh, I feel better knowing that. And I talked about imposter syndrome with Dan Cederholm a couple weeks ago on the show too. And it was like, I felt better knowing that he had the same, because, you know, anyone else looks at what he does and just marvels at it. But we all have that.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of these people too, I mean, when they're successful with it, they're able to sort of balance it with a healthy self-respect, but also to be able to use it to say, you know, I'm going to get better at this. Like I feel like, like this is not good enough, but to be able to act on it positively, I think is so critical to being able to turn into a good career, like a successful career.
You're a dad, so you'll probably, I mean, it's like parenting. There's like the kind of parent who thinks they're great and I don't trust them because their kid's going to fall out a window.
Right.
Then there's the parent who's constantly guilt-stricken at all the opportunities they are failing to provide their child and all the ways that they were, you know, gee, I should have been more patient when the baby poured dishwashing liquid over the entire floor. I shouldn't have lost my temper or whatever. It's like, I think if you're beating yourself up, that's a better track to be on.
Yeah. There's some real merit to that because it shows that you're self-aware, that you have a critical eye, which is so important, particularly for design, is to be able to look at things critically and understand them at more than just a superficial level.
Not fall so in love with your own work that you can't see what's wrong with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to take a quick commercial break. I want to thank DreamHost for making today's recording possible. Since 1997, DreamHost has helped entrepreneurs and developers the world over bring their dreams to life on the internet. I've had sites hosted by DreamHost. I'm sure you do too. They offer domain registrations, web hosting, and even powerful cloud storage and computing services. They have 1.5 million plus websites, WordPress blogs, and applications hosted on DreamHost. And that's more than 400,000 customers spanning over 100 countries. Trust DreamHost to be their online home. Packed with unbelievable value, DreamHost is the best place to launch a blog, website, or web application into the stratosphere. They're home to over 750,000 WordPress installations and have a helpful staff full of WordPress experts ready to assist you. DreamHost is the proud winner of PC Magazine's Business Choice Award for Best Web Hosting Service and has been a recommended hosting solution by WordPress.org since 2005, which is 10 years ago and ancient Internet history.
Oh my God.
Right?
Yeah.
DreamHost offers the hosting solution for individual websites or high volume enterprise sites and makes it simple to upgrade if your needs change at any time. DreamHost's award-winning in-house support staff is available all day, every day via live chat and email, 24/7, 365 days a year. DreamHost is giving the listeners of this show a special offer. Visit dreamhost.com to sign up and make sure to use the code TheBigWebShow395 at checkout. And you'll get top-rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month plus a free domain name. That's $3.95 a month hosting plus a free domain name if you check out at dreamhost.com using the code TheBigWebShow395. TheBigWebShow395, all one word. So thank you to DreamHost for supporting 5x5 and The Big Web Show. And now, with no further ado, back to Coy. When you started, how did you started doing web design right out of college, am I right?
No, actually I went into print design and I was doing a lot of brochures, A&R reports, marketing stuff, branding. And
you then studied graphic design. You knew what you were going to do, and you got a graphic design job right out of college.
I studied a degree that was a blend of illustration and graphic design. So by the time I realized it was design that I was most interested in, it was not a huge change for me in terms of the course load that I was able to choose from. And yes, when I left, I started working in graphic design, in design studios. And as the web became more important, I, you know, dipped my toe there and learned how to build a website. And then I went to a job at one of the big agencies during the first dot-com boom.
And what agency was that?
It's called Rare Medium. No longer in business.
Although I think Medium is still in business.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm sure Medium will do much better in the long run than Rare Medium.
I think they will. So is that where you met some of your behavior co-founders?
Exactly. Yeah. We were working together. And until the bubble burst in, I guess, the second half of 2000. And we started talking about building something together. And by the time Rare Medium was sort of sputtering to a finish, we had put together a plan to open a studio. And then,
A business plan? Did you have it vetted by business people or just?
No.
Made it up as you went along.
We put together a plan in terms of, these are the people that we know who might be able to give us work. And this is how we'll divide up the work.
Like divide up the responsibilities?
Yeah.
And the money. Nobody was on payroll. You're all freelance.
We were all freelancers.
How did you make the transition from a bunch of freelancers calling themselves behavior to, were you an Inc. or an LLC?
We were an LLC.
Yeah. And when did you decide to do that and start paying salaries and all that stuff?
So early 2001, we were wrapping up our work at Rare Medium and looking for freelance work. And also, each of us were privately sending out our resumes to see what else was out there. And there was not a lot of work out there. And then when September 11th happened, there was really not a lot of work out there. I mean, it was a really dark, dark time. And it sort of put my co-founders and I in this position of like, well, we better make this work because there's no other opportunity. And we were able to land a couple of clients and in some way, the silver lining of that tragic time was, it forced us to do something.
Yep. Who was your first client?
We signed JP Morgan Chase.
That was your first client out of the box.
Yeah. One of my partners had a great connect with somebody running a big program over there, and they were able to get us in and did some great work. So that really got us going.
Intranet work, or was it public facing?
It was public facing. I barely remember it now for whatever reason, but it was public facing, I believe. Yeah.
You were primarily design. Chris Fahey was probably primarily information architecture.
Yeah.
Back at that time.
Yeah. I had three other partners too.
Yeah. What did they do?
Two of them were design. One of them was like what we call a design technologist, a client side coder. And that person and I ran a lot of did a lot of the account work.
So there was no business person per se.
Later on, there was, but in the beginning, it was, the partners, the co-founders doing everything.
Sure. It's a small company and everybody, there isn't room for someone to just give the orders.
Right.
Everybody's got to work.
Yeah, that's right.
When you left, behavior was at one of its peaks. How many people were there then when you left?
There were about 25 people, and I don't remember the mix of full time and contracts, but I want to say there was probably about 10 or 12 full time, so maybe half and half.
By then, were you directing more than you were designing, or were you still doing both? Or
I was doing some design. I did a lot of design all through my time there, but I was also doing a lot of account work, and I was doing a lot of lawyers and accountants and, you know, insurance and talking with a landlord and all that stuff too. So I feel like during that period, it wasn't like I did less design. It's just like I did more of everything else as well.
Nobody tells you that either. You know, the fantasy is when I decided to start my own agency or go out on my own, it was the same thing. I said, wow, my work is what's bringing in the money here. Why don't I just go do it? And I'm not getting supported emotionally. Why don't I just, put myself in charge and I'll pick my clients? And nobody tells you, sometimes you can't pick clients and sometimes it's incredibly lean and there's all kinds of laws that seem not, it's weird. You turn slightly Republican, even if you're a Democrat. When you become, and you're like, wait, so I'm creating these jobs and I'm going to pay taxes twice. Right. I mean, I hate to say it, but like all these Republican talking points that never made sense to me suddenly made a great deal of sense. I was like,
It was my first business. And when I really understood how deeply tax thinking, tax strategy drives so much of the way the business works, it was a shock to me.
By the way, businesses, as we know, take advantage of the tax code too. Like people make stuff to lose money because there's an advantage. There's an advantage to that. It'd be like I can think of no other reason for a human endeavor where many people are working on something. It's a product that will never see the light of day.
Yeah.
Except for budgetary reasons or for tax reasons. It's like crazy. And of course, that's what's fueling the big startup flurry that we're in now. It's like, people want to lose big or win big, but nothing in between.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me about The Onion, because that still breaks my heart that we, all these years later, that we pitched The Onion and you got The Onion. And I think that was one of the last things you brought in and finished before you left for the New York Times. But what was that? What was your meeting with The Onion like? And how did you know that you had it? When did you know that you were getting it? What was that like?
You know, I never really knew that we got it until we heard. There was never a moment of extreme confidence. In fact, there was a meeting where we sat down, I think at our offices with some of the staff from The Onion, and we had some partners there and some of our staff. And someone from The Onion, Peter Keckley, who's editor at the time and whom I'm still friends with, he's actually a co-founder right now at, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't remember the name.
Of your product?
No. He is Upworthy. Who are doing fantastic.
It was Peter, the very tall guy who looked like...
Sean, I believe.
Okay.
Sean. So Peter was a writer and he became editor. Yeah.
So Peter was the little Jewish guy with curly hair?
No, I don't even remember who that was. No. Peter Midwestern guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You probably had more meetings than we did, and that's how you... you were actually in a meeting with this guy and going meeting. Like, oh, this is not going well.
Yeah, there was a meeting where he sort of asked somebody on the team, I can't remember who, like what that person thought about their RFP or some particular point in the RFP. And the person replied, very frankly, I haven't read it yet.
Wow.
And my heart sank because I was like, oh my God, all this effort, we just lost this account.
Wow.
Yeah, and there was nervous laughter in the room, and I actually think they appreciated the frankness. That was one of those scary moments where I was like, I sort of felt the floor like buckling under me.
I'm very infantile and competitive in weird ways, and I remember when you got it, my thought was, but I'm funnier than Coy. Not like who's better or whose company's well equipped to do the job, or, and then afterwards I was like, they'll do a great job. This is awesome. You know, congratulations. But before that, I was like, but I'm funnier. I should have gotten like the Onion was going, we're so witty and jovial. We need someone really. I was always making with the jokes to be our designer. Come on, you make with the jokes. I can't hire a designer. And then like later I was like, you know, they make with the jokes. They don't need a designer to make with the jokes. They need a designer to, but you know, but you're like, I'm just talking about ego and like,
well, you are funnier than me.
I am funnier. There's like a lot of things you're better at, but I think I'm funnier. Right. But,
Actually, one of the things I found working with the Onion is they were just great people, all of them, but they were not particularly funny. Like just to be hanging out with them. They were not like, it was not like working with like the cast from Saturday Night Live or something. They weren't constantly like cracking jokes.
It's probably more like working with the cast of The Daily Show, who are probably very serious, especially Jon Stewart. Like you'd expect him to be making with the jokes, and he's just like, yeah, this situation in Kazakhstan, and you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. I feel trivial and shallow. I thought you didn't. There was a period where the only way I was getting the news was through The Daily Show. But you, of course.
Come to an end.
How did you make the decision to leave an agency you co-founded and work at the New York Times? That must have been tough, and I'm wondering what helped you decide I have to do this.
That was a really hard decision. I left after 4 years, five years, I can't remember exactly. And I had put everything into that company and worked so hard. In the end, like the main reason was that the Times was an opportunity I felt like I would not have again. And I really, really wanted to do it, really just wanted to see what that was like. I'd been such a huge fan of the Times for so long. But also, I felt like I didn't know how much longer I was going to last at Behavior. I mean, I had terrific partners, but we sort of all jumped into this adventure together without really knowing what it entailed. And there were too many of us, and there were five partners in total, which is, you know, was a huge lesson for me. Like, you don't want to do that. Like, you want one other partner, maybe, or maybe two, but five was just sort of overboard. And I felt like life was going to be easier for everybody if somebody stepped away. And I had this great opportunity to do that. So I didn't want to leave the company, but ultimately I decided, you know, this was going to be a net positive for me.
And you were able to leave without jeopardizing the company.
Right.
Yeah. You don't have to answer, but were you bought out or did you just leave?
I left. Yeah.
Were you married at this time?
No, it was not. Okay. But part of what was hard for me was we were having a really hard time. Like, when you have a consultancy, like, you know, they say like the net worth of the company walks out the door every night. It's hard in a services business to build sort of intrinsic value in the company itself and not in and not have it reside like in the people who are actually doing the work.
I've never understood when agencies are acquired how that works, because basically a couple of top people may stay, a lot of other people will move on, and or people buy an agency because of its reputation and then they get rid of the staff and put their own people in, and you're like, what did you just, that's like buying a URL and removing all the content, and then what did you buy? You bought a name, you bought a brand, but you're going to ruin it.
Right. Or they'll buy a services business or an agency when the agency has like really super well established credentials in a given industry or connections in an industry, or when they've built, a clientele who are willing to go on retainer for years at a time, when there's a lot of recurring revenue, predictable revenue in a company. For us at the time, anyway, you know, we might have been doing great, you know, in February, but March,
everything could have just gone quiet. And there was no recurring revenue streams to underpin that.
Tell me in the few minutes we have left about Wildcard.
So Wildcard is a startup. We're located here in downtown New York. There are three co-founders. I'm not a co-founder. I was, I think, maybe the fifth or sixth employee, including the co-founders. We're trying to build a better mobile web. Our thinking is that there are two ways to access the internet on your phone. One is through a web browser, which has tremendous breadth, but mobile browsers can be unreliable and can be kind of painful to use. The other is a native app, which everybody loves and drives terrific engagement, but having to go and grab a native app to engage with a brand like...
It's a barrier.
Nike, yeah, there's a barrier. So we're building...
And especially when you maybe start on, you know, you get an email that says, Samantha wants to meet you on some dating website, and then you click and it sends you to the website, and then it says, but maybe you want to use our app instead, and do you already have it? And then you go to the app store and it says, oh, you already have it. Open it. And then you open it and hope that through all of this it's been able to, because you really want to know who Samantha is, or so I've read. I'm just imagining, but like that's an interaction that's starts on the web or starts on mail. And so how do you bridge all that?
So we believe that we can create a third way, which gives you the breadth of a web browser, but the richness of a native app. So we have an iOS app right now, an iPhone app that is written, you know, in native iOS code, but is sort of backed by these really sophisticated server-side processes that can go out and grab any given website and return it to you, return only the things that you need, only the content, and sort of leave behind all the other cruft that you might have to download in a mobile browser, and use the richness of the native app speed and UI to render this stuff very, very quickly.
So this is Orbital Content. This is the promise of Orbital Content that, and for a publisher, like I publish a list apart, I could make cards, kind of like Twitter cards, but article cards, right? Or if I were in a product business, I could make product cards. Mm-hmm. Is that just something else I put in the header, which generates actually, that stuff? It's a field in my CMS.
Yeah, it's very similar to Twitter card integration. Actually, we have a WordPress plugin that will make it really easy to do that right now. But even before that, before we had that, I enabled Twitter cards on my blog, subtraction.com, and that basically paved the way for getting my content inside the Wildcard app. So it's very simple.
Yeah, I have Twitter cards on my blog. We have Twitter cards on a list part. And yeah, well, after the show, I'm going to be seeing you again later today, but I'm very interested in this. Just another way to get my content in someone's hands. I'm pretty platform neutral at this point. I love the web. I will always love the web. But if someone wants to get it, you know, if someone wants to read it on however they want to read it, however they choose how they want to read it, they choose what they want to use. I don't. And this seems like a very interesting project. What's the theory behind, you basically give your phone number to get the product downloaded. What is that? Are you in testing still? Is that why?
Oh, no. That's just one method. You can go right to the App Store and download it. You can just look for Wildcard in the App Store. If you go to our site.
On your website, it still says that though, and you still take phone numbers.
Yeah, if you want a link directly sent to your phone, you can just throw your phone number in there, and that will, you know.
So it's not a private beta or anything like that.
Right. No, we don't require the phone number by any means. It's just a way to help smooth that friction between getting from a desktop browser to an installation on your phone.
Cool. Well, I'm obviously too free with my phone number, but that's okay. I trust you. What are video cards for Wildcard?
Yeah, video cards will play, a YouTube video, a Vimeo video, like right inside of our app. We're working on lots of different card types to support lots of different types of content.
Where did you get the fonts? What fonts are you using?
That's Galaxy Polaris, which we license from Village Typography. It's a really beautiful, surprisingly underused font. And Village has really...
Is it a web font as well?
There is a web font. We license the app versions.
Sure.
But there's separate licensing for the web. Yes.
But it is.
Yes.
It's very beautiful. It has tremendous readability, and it's very sharp at the same time.
Yeah, I'm surprised this font isn't used more widely. I'm actually happy it's not because we really like it a lot. And Village has, they're not, it's not like a $10 font, but it costs real money, but it's actually quite reasonable, and their licensing terms are pretty startup friendly. So we were happy all around when we found that.
Well, I could talk to you all day, but we can't. So I want to thank you. Really good talking to you. I'll see you later today. And thank you for coming on the Big Web Show. Thank you, listeners, for listening. If you have questions for Coy, what's the best way to reach you?
You can go to my site, subtraction.com. My Twitter is at Coy, K-H-O-I. Or you can sign up for the book and get an early bird discount at howtheygotthere.us. All one word, howtheygotthere.us.
There was a howtheygotthere.com. That must have really ticked you off.
I know. That was too bad. But it's the internet.
Well, thank you very much. And
thanks for having me. Super fun.
Pleasure. And thank you, DreamHost, for sponsoring. We'll see you again on another Big Web Show.